The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, our weekly deep dive into the latest news in ad tech, media and marketing. I'm John Still, Head of Content, and today I'm joined by not one but two of my ExchangeWire colleagues. First off, research lead and all-round analytical brain, Matt Broughton. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, John. Great to be here. Analytical brain, it's the first time I've heard that.
Thought I'd give you a new intro. And we also have our CEO, Lindsay Rountree, joining. Welcome back, Lindsay.
CEO? Yes, I've been promoted. Brilliant. Oh, thanks, John.
God. CEO. Good.
And one so it days. Begins.
One of those days, guys. COO, Lindsay Rountree, our general chaos coordinator. Anyway, onto the news, because the intro has gone terribly. So TikTok is betting that people are going to watch videos on bigger screens. TikTok are breaking out from your mobile screens with their new out-of-phone offering. The platform is bringing TikTok videos to billboards, cinemas, bars, airports, and beyond. The content will be tailored to different audiences and regularly refreshed to share only the latest and most engaging videos from the app itself. So TikTok's been all-conquering in terms of its social media platform. Can it go beyond that? Lindsay, do you think this bet's going to work for TikTok?
I find it really interesting. When I first read the headline, I thought, oh, you mean TV? I thought people already watch TikTok on TV. Like, so what's the big deal? But I then obviously read it, and this, I do like the fact they've called it out of phone. I enjoyed that very much. I like a little word pun. But it's interesting because I need... The US advertising ecosystem looks very, very different from the UK advertising ecosystem in terms of how they manage out of home. You know, they've got things like out of home could be a screen in a doctor's surgery. It could be a screen in a petrol station. It could be a billboard outside of like a mum and pop like shop in a corner shop in a small town. And there's so many different media owners across the out of home ecosystem in the US versus the UK, where there's literally a handful. So from that perspective, it looks very, very different, and probably where it's probably a market where it could work really, really well versus the same kind of format in the UK. I'm unclear as to whether this is an advertising offering or whether this is just like them choosing their favorite TikToks to promote, and what the goal of it is. They're pretty locked down on Gen Z, right? They've got that audience only to promote to them. Are they trying to get an older audience in? They'll be displaying it, what, in cinemas and in various kind of outdoor physical locations. And I think it will depend on how well they can engage with audiences in these new environments and what that actually looks like. Like, what does it look like in practice? Will brands be able to take part in it? So if I were a brand that already advertises on TikTok, would I be able to pay more to advertise in these out-of-phone environments? And would there be better targeting opportunities to be able to get like an older audience or a different kind of audience versus what I think I can get on the TikTok platform itself? I'm so intrigued with how it actually works. I really, really actually want to find out more about how it would work and kind of where it would display and what the targeting options are. And if it's just them literally using an algorithm to choose their favorite or most popular TikToks, or actually kind of engaging with brands and allowing brands to advertise through them. But that makes it more complicated too, because it's like a different format within out of home, for example, within cinema. So where these brands already advertise in cinema or already advertise in out of home, they're now advertising in those areas, but through TikTok, so TikTok's becoming a media owner in those areas potentially. And that's what makes it, I feel like this asks more questions than it answers. And that's what I think is really, really interesting about it. I think there's a lot that can be done with it, from like content tailoring to expanding, obviously, its ecosystem to beyond the Gen Z audience, which know and love it. Being able to engage in a different way, I think in those outdoor environments, short form will work really, really well. I'd personally be very engaged with it. I personally used to really enjoy the TikTok TV campaign that was running probably during the pandemic now. I used to quite enjoy engaging with those videos and going, oh, that's quite cool. And it got me downloading TikTok. So if that's the goal as well, then it could work really well. But I think that if it's trying to just put its videos in different areas, it could be interesting. If it's trying to become a new media channel outside of the mobile environment and compete with other media channels and more traditional advertising, I'd be very intrigued as to what that looks like in practice and how they can work with brands on that.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I echo Lindsay's sentiments. I've got so many different questions about how it would actually look and work in practice. I feel in theory, I think it could be a very shrewd move. And I think marketers could be very, very interested in it. I think the further amplification of TikTok campaigns will appeal to marketers and, you know, add further appeal in terms of the multi-channel strategies, which everyone's trying to implement in terms of out of home. People have, you know, traditionally used it more as an extension of TV campaigns or display campaigns. But I agree with Lindsay in terms of that social short form content. It could, you know, revolutionize out of home as a channel. But at the same time, what kind of content would they run against it? What kind of, you know, targeting? They say it's going to be targeted to different audiences, but then they say we'll only show the, you know, best and most engaging videos for it. You know, how are they going to tailor that, you know, inventory? You know, I just get the image of drivers going up and down Old Street with videos of people dropping Mentos into Coke bottles blaring on in the background. It's just, is that necessarily going to work as a channel? But yeah, it could be. Could be very interesting. And I think, you know, if you're an out-of-home marketer, I think you'd be equally as interested in this as, you know, wider extensions of display and TV.
Yeah, it seems, you know, Lindsay, you both really hit upon interesting stuff there in terms of where TikTok see themselves going. And, you know, they have conquered the Gen Z market. They have taken over the phone screens. But to your point, Matt, you can't swipe a billboard. You can't flick randomly through an out-of-home advert. It is there serving short-form videos to you, but the inability to move through it at your own pace. Is that removing one of their USPs, Lindsay, do you think?
That's actually a really interesting point that I hadn't thought of. Yes, it probably is, because the beauty of TikTok is I can go, no, not of interest, boring, like just keep swiping. And that's why it's ruined everyone's attention spans. But I think that you're absolutely right. Like in that environment, yes, it's only probably going to be a 10, 15, 20 second video, but it would be enough for me to go, oh my God, this is so boring. And actually, because I can't move it on, and I'm sitting there waiting for the next video in whatever environment I'm watching this in, it could look very, very different. Also, you know, also raises the point of will the formats be the same? Because watching a phone screen sized video on a cinema screen will be a little bit odd. So, how are they going to manage that? And also if it's on billboards or on miniature TV screens in out of phone environments, again, it isn't necessarily conducive to what they actually have created with TikTok. I guess it raises the question as to what you just said it yourself, John. What are they trying to be now? Where are they trying to go?
Yeah, it's, you know, breaking away from that mobile screen and out into something else, but also creating a potentially new business model for them, I suppose. You know, images are conjured of people straining while they're driving to try and watch someone finishing their butterboard and going into the bumper in front of them.
Finishing their what now?
Was butterboard? I don't use TikTok. Was butterboards a trend on TikTok?
What's a butterboard?
So you take like a chopping board and cover it in butter, and then put salt and pepper and cheese and stuff over the top of it, and then that's the meal.
No, you're right. Butterboards are in. Spread the word, according to the New York Times back in 2022.
That's probably where I read it. Yeah. So, yeah, stuff, you know, like Matt
sounds
said.
Like some form of calorific torture, that.
It does. There's an article headline from The Guardian from October, this time last year. What is a butterboard and how would I even eat that? Yeah. I have the same question.
That's the one I would have read, and I was so repulsed by it. I've remembered it for a year, and I have it. And whenever I need a TikTok trend to bring to mind, then that's the one. But anyway, yes, it's an interesting move for sure. And you know, they have a grip on people's attention on their phone screens. So it's, I suppose, a natural progression really to try and make it work. I think it's interesting for brands. You know, they're getting to grips with how to be effective on TikTok, and now the game's going to change slightly. Lindsay, do you think they'll have to consider, that TikTok is not just for short form. It's now big screen. It's now out of home. Do you think they'll change their minds in terms of how they plan for this?
Potentially. I mean, I think that it's, and that's actually another really interesting point you raise. It's much like any new ad format. It's moving away from the, you know, the old school, I'm a media planner, I work with a creative team. Creative teams love creating TV spots. I need a 5-second video for a digital campaign. They say, here you go, I've just cut the 30-second TV spot by 25 seconds. Here's a 5-second video you can use. And you go, well, that's not remotely fit for purpose. And this could be a similar sort of thing, like, can I use the same assets I already have in a TikTok environment? Or they work in a new environment when you need to create completely new assets. And is that something that I actually want to do when I could probably target that audience in different environments anyway? So, and you know, there's not even actually any word that brands will be able to engage in this format. It's they haven't really mentioned that. They just talked about their own videos. So, you know, we might be jumping the gun a bit, but it would be stupid not to, really. It would make a lot of sense for them to be able to engage with, for brands to be able to engage with it as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about it coming up and hearing of its success or how it does. So we will keep an eye on it. Moving on to our second story of the day, Apple's carbon neutral claims are going to come under some scrutiny. After Apple's claims that its latest devices are carbon neutral, the San Cupertino tech giant faces scrutiny from European environmental and consumer groups. Apple made environmentally friendly credentials central to its latest campaigns, including the star-studded Mother Nature video. Matt, so Apple are really pushing the carbon neutral side of things, and how carefully should they be treading with this stuff? How do you feel about their latest positioning?
I think brands should be treading very, very carefully, at least in terms of their outward messaging. Brands should 100% be doing all they can to drive down their carbon emissions. But in terms of their messaging around that, they need to be so much more careful, because so much more people are aware of the actual mechanics of, you know, carbon emissions, what can be done to reduce them. We've seen loads of stories in recent months about the legitimacy and actual effectiveness of things like carbon credits. You know, how much carbon do they actually drive down? And I think in terms of a lot of the corporate messaging around sustainability, I think a lot of it, unfortunately, has been a smokescreen at the moment. You know, diving into Apple particularly, their 2021 sustainability report proudly boasts so many occurrences of it saying carbon neutral for corporate emissions, which on paper sounds lovely. Like, as a corporation, they're carbon neutral, happy days. But that's after around 660,000 tons of offsetting through these carbon credits, which may be, I don't want to say dubious, but their legitimacy has been questioned. And it excludes emissions related to their products. So even after offsetting in that 2021 financial year, it still had 22.5 million tons of its carbon footprint, which obviously it's huge, and that's what we need to focus on in terms of driving it down. And saying you're carbon neutral, even if it's obviously cleverly worded to say, yes, your corporate emissions may be zero, but at the same time, that's including offsetting and excluding product. It's a very difficult line to tread. And I think now the market's looking more towards actually, you know, how much are you driving down your emissions by? I think it's something that brands have to be very, very careful on.
Yeah. Lindsay, what do you think about Apple's positioning and Brussels' reaction to it potentially?
I think what I really, really enjoy at the moment is that Brussels and Europe more generally just has it in for Apple. There's just so many different, there's obviously the radiation issue with the iPhone 12. Then there's obviously the iPhone 15 they've had to launch with the USB-C charger. And that is apparently from pressure from the EU about having standardized charging systems so that they weren't being different. And now there's obviously this as well. But I mean, I agree with Brussels on the greenwashing thing. It's a huge issue. But I think the challenge that we have here is that if Brussels says one thing, the US says something else, in APAC they say something else, there's no standardization across everything. And then large corporations like Apple just struggle to really be able to do the right thing. Now, I'm not saying that really is ever a great concern for them. They want to be able to say the right thing rather than do the right thing. And I watched that Mother Nature video, and I cringed until I could cringe no more. If you haven't seen it, Octavia Spencer plays Mother Nature, and you've got all these Apple execs, including Tim Cook, around the table kind of going, yes, we've saved this many billion gallons of water. Yes, our offices are completely carbon neutral. Yes, this brand new Apple Watch is completely carbon neutral. And it's just all, like, frankly, just looks like a bunch of, like, corporate wank.
It's so wonderful as well, because for accessibility reasons, they provided the transcript for it. which if you read that without obviously watching the video, it just reads like the most weird dystopian corporate wank you've ever laid eyes on. And the thing I love most particularly, there's obviously a direction or at least transcription of it. Tim blinks. Focus in on the shot where Tim Cook blinked. But yeah, it's just ridiculous. It's like, you know, Mother Nature, you're not trying to bribe Mother Nature with Apple swag. Lisa, it's Apple's very first carbon neutral product. We've planted forests. And it's just absolute turd binge.
It's really is. I mean, if you haven't seen it, just Google Apple Mother Nature. It's worth it. I mean Matt is doing it justice to the transcript, it really is, but it's even better to watch it in person. But I think that video sums up what Brussels is talking about, which is kind of this greenwashing and kind of this corporate speak of we are carbon neutral, we are net zero, all these different times of terminologies when they need to really be able to prove that they are these things, they're doing these things. It's not just we're still actually making products that are releasing this much carbon into the world, but planting a few trees, when the whole tree planting thing, you know, should be long gone now. We all know that 20% of trees that are planted don't even grow into anything. And so many companies have got in trouble for that kind of stuff. I'm not saying Apple have just said they're planting trees, because that's obviously not what they've said. Because they actually said, no, we're not planting trees, we're planting forests. So, you know, they are taking it one step further by planting entire forests, apparently. But I just think that it feels like a PR stunt rather than a genuine commitment to the carbon emissions problem and the sustainability and environment problem. And they need to balance what they're doing in their marketing efforts with an actual responsibility, with corporate responsibility to addressing these issues. And that's where I think the disconnect often happens with a lot of these companies. And so I think it's not a bad idea for Brussels to step in and say, enough of this now, you need to be able to prove you're doing this. It makes a lot of sense. And I think that as brands, it would help them too, to be able to prove they're doing it rather than, I don't necessarily understand. I don't know. You know, we look into this a lot because obviously our industry is very carbon emissive. So we obviously have a probably greater opinion on this kind of stuff than maybe your average person walking down the street. I don't know. Some people are really into it. Some people couldn't give two shits. But I think that the problem with this is, and this is what Brussels is trying to address, the PR stunts make everyone think, oh, good, I'm living a really kind of like honest, pure life because everything I buy is carbon neutral, when actually it's complete bollocks. And I'm swearing a lot today. I do apologise for listeners for my swearing. But it's nothing. And all these people are believing this. So actually what Brussels are doing is actually trying to hopefully help the consumer in some way as well, to be able to be informed and make the right decisions, rather than these companies just spouting all this greenwashing crap down your throat and you believing that that's true and going, well, everything I buy is carbon neutral, so obviously it must be fine, when it clearly is not.
Yeah, very good of Apple to provide a transcript for the video that will save the prosecutors a job. anyway, I think you've hit on a couple of points that are really interesting there in terms of standardization around this. You know, we're looking at this for industry review this year in sustainability, and standardization has to be a big question globally as well as, you know, in its regions. We need this to guard against greenwashing. Do you think that's the next step, is a real like applicable standard for this? Matt, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I 100% reckon that standardization needs to come in. And it's encouraging that governments are acting upon this. Obviously, Lindsay's flagged the EU, but also the Australian government, as part of research we ran in JPAC earlier this year. It's released a climate disclosure paper where basically they're planning, if you're a company of 100 employees or more, or you have a turnover of 50 million Aussie dollars by the end of 2028, you have to report your direct emissions, and also you must make meaningful efforts. That's obviously not quite as technical as you'd like it to be, but still meaningful efforts to measure your scope 3 emissions as well. And I think that's been what's holding back a lot of companies in actually having meaningful numbers behind what you're actually emitting. And we've seen efforts in the ad tech industry, a lot of different players popping up in terms of measuring, which is obviously a good thing. But yeah, having those tools and having standardization across those tools across different markets will really help companies to be, you know, actually able to say, this is how much I'm emitting, how much can I drive that down by, rather than, I don't know how much I'm emitting, well, let's plant a couple of trees and say we're carbon neutral.
Yeah, and Lindsay, you hit on the point that, you know, it's consumers. You're walking away with a spring in your step, thinking that your watch is doing no damage to the environment. Little knowing what actually is going on. Do you think these standards would really help people understand that, you know, not just what the industry is doing, but what they can do and what products are, you know, really, really trying to help this situation?
I'd like to think so. I always compare these kind of things with the food industry, because I think that the food industry, when it comes to standardization and regulation, is further ahead, but also it's not that far ahead, in the sense that standardization is really, really important as long as it's set by governments, not by companies. But those governments can't then be funded by those companies that allow the standardization to be measured by the ways the companies want it to be measured and not by the ways that it should be measured scientifically, and that makes the most logical, sane sense. And I think that in the UK, we have food labels, and those food labels help massively. If something's red, I know it's bad. If something's green, I know it's good. When it comes to things like sugar, when it comes to carbs, when it comes to all the, like, you know, the potentially bad stuff in food, or the good stuff too. And that's helped massively. But actually, it's now turning out that that's not the right thing to be putting on food labels. And we should be labeling if something is ultra processed, et cetera, et cetera, because that's causing more harm. Just because it's low sugar doesn't mean it's actually healthy for you. That low sugar has just been filled with loads of other crap instead to replace the sugar. But actually, that crap's probably worse for you than the sugar probably was in the first place. And so there's now call about kind of like, and I think Chile have done it, and South American countries have done it, where they're actually kind of a bit like a tobacco warning label, are putting warning labels on ultra processed food to say this is actually dangerous for you, don't eat it. And I think that the reason that we've got to that stage is because previously the companies like Nestle, like P&G, were probably the UPF companies, were helping fund governments to kind of help fund these food labels. And so it was thought that it was the right thing. And actually, it turns out from a health and obesity perspective, it wasn't the right thing. I fear we might go in a similar direction with sustainability and environmental emissions. I fear that companies that want certain things to look good and want to be able to prove they're doing certain things that actually scientifically actually aren't helping the environment will help to advise on what the right metrics are that the public are exposed to, that again, a bit like saying right now I'm carbon neutral, well actually they're not at all, will make consumers think that everything's fine when actually it's not. So there needs to be a real effort to ensure that these standards that are hopefully sorted out by governments and by NGOs that are kind of working with governments very closely, that aren't being funded by the likes of potentially Apple, because I could see Apple being one of the companies that would fund these kinds of pieces of research, are going in the right direction and not just pulling the wool over the eyes of the average buyer.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, again, this is something that will be big over the next year in terms of the standardization and what consumers really need to know about what does help the environment, what does actually count as a carbon reduction. So again, an area we will be keeping a strong eye on coming up over the next year. Final story of the day, we're going to stick on a responsibility theme, but this time around artificial intelligence. AI companies must be made liable for harms caused by their products, a group of senior experts has warned, describing it as utterly reckless to pursue ever more powerful AI systems before understanding how to make them safe. One of the signatories, Professor of Computer Science at University of California, Stuart Russell, has said, these are not toys. Increasing their capabilities before we understand how to make them safe is utterly reckless. Adding, there are more regulations on sandwich shops than there are on AI companies. AI is, again, a massive area that we're looking at this year, that we're hearing a lot of, that has really taken over. And it's having an impact on our industry as well as it is on many others. Lindsay, how do you think regulation and responsibility can be meted out around AI, and should it be, and what are the use cases?
I think that, I mean, I think I said this on the podcast a few months ago, but the problem with tools like AI that are developing so quickly, generative AI is you know, it's very difficult to keep up with. Even if you literally kind of live and breathe it, it's difficult to keep up with all the changes that are being made on a day-to-day basis. And unfortunately, regulators, governments, and ethics committees are normally pretty far behind and are trying to keep up with all these changes. And everyone's finding their feet. So everyone, you know, it's going to be really bad before it gets good, I think, is the thing here. We're going to see a massive, massive increase in deep fakes from videos, from audio, from kind of whatever you can imagine. People, there's going to be lots of bank fraud. There's going to be lots of image fraud. It's not going to be a good time, I don't think, because regulators need to work out what the right things here are to do. And again, it's one of those tough things when it comes to anything internet related, is that it transcends governments. So governments will do what they can to cover their own bases. But what happens in the country next door is, you know, something they have little control over. And again, you know, we keep talking about it, and hate to repeat ourselves for the third time, but we need standardization on this kind of thing. And again, is that global? Is that on a government by government level? It's really, really difficult to know. But also, trying to bring safety into it and trying to bring standardization into kind of what we can regulate in terms of data privacy, in terms of general safety of AI usage, needs to be balanced with actually not stifling the ability to be able to innovate within the area, because there's so much excitement, so many exciting things we can do with AI, that it would be a shame to literally kind of curb it all and then not be able to make use of something that could genuinely help everybody, from the kind of the tiniest, most random thing to kind of really big systems in place that can actually help, you know, potentially make governments work more efficiently, make hospitals work more efficiently. There's so much that it can do that we need to not be able to not block that and not limit that, but we have to bring in rules and regulations, because it's going to be a shit show.
Yeah. Mads, to that point, has the horse bolted?
Yes, but I reckon it's bolted, but you know, with a long enough lasso, it can be brought back. But it's going to take a long while to make that lasso to really stretch that analogy out way beyond breaking point. I completely agree with Lindsay in the sense that governments understandably have been slower to regulate on this. Obviously, a story in the Exchange Wire Digest this morning is that, you know, there's progress being made on the EU front, which is obviously lovely, but this is after the release of, you know, GPT 3.5 and then the subsequent release of GPT 4, which is obviously so much more capable than even that advanced AI system was. It's there's going to be a lag in between, which obviously may exacerbate some of the issues around AI, particularly in terms of that data security, data and systems protection piece. Obviously, you know, one government may be trying to do the right thing and regulate against it. Other governments may be looking to exploit AI for their own purposes. And it's obviously a very wide geopolitical issue. I do have confidence that, you know, that legislative framework will be put in place, but it's going to take a while. And I think the more that individual companies, industry bodies, the more discussion we can have around it, the more protections, you know, industries can put in place on their front of things before the legislative frameworks catch up, can only be a good thing.
Yeah, it seems to be, you know, a proceed with caution situation for some companies who are using AI for work. And we've heard a lot of different use cases this year about how brands, agencies that we discuss with and we talk with are really bringing AI into the fold and really impacting their work. Lindsay, is caution the byword here? Do you think that companies should really be considering deeply how they use AI in their workdays?
I think definitely companies and individuals, because it's not just a company-led thing as well. Like, I might choose an individual to use ChatGPT for all manner of things, and those things I might not be telling my my company that I'm using them for. And actually, are they the right things? Is it ethical what I'm doing? Is it actually part of my job description that the way I'm using AI, is it an effective use of things, or is it actually helping me be more efficient and do my job properly? There needs to be, from a kind of the tools that a company builds, and John, you mentioned there about, you know, the way some like certain companies in our industry use it, like, and there are certain agencies that are building all of their systems and all their tools on AI, and that's really exciting and really interesting to see how that's going to work, but also kind of help their teams work more efficiently. And you know, the companies I've got in my head, I'll use Brain Labs as an example, because I spoke to them quite recently, is their intention has never been and will never be to reduce staff as a result of that. Is to get their staff to be doing more interesting, more exciting things. And that's always been the creation of any tool, is to try to kind of help us, you know, the creation of any multi-platform reporting tool. I remember when I used to work in paid search, the likes of Kenshu and Marin came out, everyone was a bit concerned about not being able to optimize campaigns themselves. But actually, once you got going, you were going, this is brilliant. I actually haven't got to spend 5 hours a day doing reporting now. I can actually go and like look into stuff and be strategic and look at how I can actually improve stuff for my clients. And the reports are peripheral to that. So there's all these different things that will make a person's life easier. But there needs to be ruling around, to a degree, ruling around what the guardrails are for how employees use the likes of AI, be it for systems that the company themselves have created, but also for systems that they are using themselves that are publicly available, like ChatGPT, for example. Because I think there will be some confusion around that, and there'll be some people in a team where person A is doing everything manually and you know, doesn't really know what to do anything and is Googling endlessly trying to find out how to work things. And person B is using ChatGPT for everything and doing everything in half the time. Well, actually, you know, it's a weird thing. Are they telling person A they're doing that, or are they pretending they're just super efficient and they know what they're doing? And is it actually, does the company want person B to be using ChatGPT for all this stuff, or would they rather that person A has the right approach and actually does this stuff themselves rather than using an AI tool? And should there be kind of guidelines in place as to how these different tools that are publicly available are used? And that's just one small example of a plethora of different things that companies will come up against over the coming months, years. And then also I want to touch on the education piece as well, because like in the last story, education will be huge here beyond what we're doing. Because if we are using AI to create adverts, is it incumbent upon us to say when an ad is shown, like, you know, I might be on a website and see a banner ad, is it incumbent upon the company or the SSP or whatever, the ad server, to say, this is not a real baby. This is an AI baby. Like, will I be looking at things thinking they're human? And actually think about like all of the different mascara companies that exist and how they've always in trouble all the time for pretending their mascara is making these like massive, like 3 foot long lashes, when actually they're false eyelashes. Well, how is there going to be, there's going to be so much abuse on that kind of stuff when it comes to creative. I'm going on a massive, massive tangent here. But again, that points to the education of humans. Like, you know, if I, sorry, Dad, but if I said ChatGPT to my dad, I think he might say, bless you, because he thought I'd sneezed. Like, I don't actually think most people, again, you know, we exist in a bubble to a degree. Most people walking down the street won't have a clue what's going on with all this AI stuff in the background. And it's going to really, really improve the capabilities of chatbots when it comes to them talking to their, you know, their service providers for various different things. At the moment, you can pretty normally, hopefully most people can tell they're talking to a chatbot because it's fairly standardized. The answers are the same and they'll know they're talking to a human. Very soon, they won't know they're talking to a chatbot and they'll think they're talking to a human. And again, is it incumbent upon the company to say this is not a human you're talking to? There's so many different things. And as I'm talking, more and more things come in my head. So I'm going to stop talking. Matt, please save me.
When you were going on there, I just had the wonderful image of, this is not just an eye, this is an M&S eye. but yeah, there's so many different applications that, you know, our industry can use AI for, but we need to have those protections in place in terms of, you know, data privacy, copywriting. I reckon it will eventually come to a point where that labeling thing will become, you know, key in terms of, this is either produced by AI. And I can envisage a similar kind of system to, you know, GDPR and consent, where in terms of copyrighted work, you know, AI systems shouldn't be used to train on copyrighted work. But if you give it consent, then it can. And then you can obviously withdraw that thereafter if you decide for other, you know, commercial reasons to withdraw it. If I can kind of be, you know, promotional and tease something up in the coming weeks, we do have a study from ExchangeWire coming out focusing in on AI, and it's going to become endemic within the industry in terms of how it's being used, because it can drive efficiencies. And I think, you know, we really should be looking to AI for its potential in terms of obviously increasing profitability, freeing up companies to, you know, spend money more on their people rather than, you know, these kind of processes that in a few years, I'm sure will view as archaic. But at the same time, we need to ensure those protections are in place. And I think, you know, the industry's in a good place in terms of recognizing the potential issues around data security, and wanting to, you know, have those concerns resolved before further diving in?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's an awful lot to unpack with these questions, and we'll be doing that, like you said, Matt, in the ExchangeWise study we've got coming up and across our content. Lindsay, I think what you were talking about in terms of a level playing field is fascinating. A few weeks ago, we talked about a story where a company had made an AI image of an ad on top of a London bus. And I came on the podcast to talk about it. I was actually quite glib about it. It's like, well, it's, you know, it's creative, it's gone online, and not a lot of people would have seen the campaign. So it's actually quite, you know, quite a fun way of doing it. Who cares if it's AI? And then after I'd said that on the podcast, had a little bit more of a think about it. And, you know, there was questions rose about the media planners who actually put money into their campaigns to buy that kind of real estate and that kind of advertising space. What about TfL, who sell advertising space on the buses? Was that robbing them of an actual space on their own IP? So yes, many questions, and that just came to my mind in terms of how, you know, standardization in particular is going to help level this playing field. So at least if we all have the same tools, then we can all play by the same rules. But fascinating. We'll keep an eye on it for sure. Both of you, thank you very much for your time today. That was a really great, if a little foul-mouthed conversation. So,
well, I had a great time, so thank you.
It was wonderful, and we will we'll do it again soon. Matt, thank you very much for your time. Lindsay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you all very much for listening. We will be back next week. This is the Mad Tech Podcast. Thanks.